This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Bridget Dowd. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of July 21st, 2025. The Central Arizona Project. It sounds more like a band name than the name of a critical 336-mile-long aqueduct that shuttles Colorado River water through the state. While you may have heard of CAP or CAP, you may not be exactly sure how it all works. KJZZ's Phil Latzman recently took a behind-the-scenes tour of the system that keeps the flow going for millions of Arizonans.
We were invited to a blow-off. You are hearing it. The sound of millions of gallons of water being discharged from a one-mile-long siphon in northwest Phoenix.
We're at the Agua Fria siphon, and what CAP is doing essentially is we're gearing up for prescribed maintenance to keep this siphon in operation, which is a critical part of the infrastructure that delivers water from Lake Havasu to Tucson.
What happens if you don't do that?
There's going to be a lot of angry folks out there, I'll tell.
This is Jason Terrell, CAP's senior project manager.
You think most people know what you guys do?
Absolutely not. It's funny, I think a lot of questions come up for me and I'm sure a lot of other folks here at CAP when we go out and we meet up with friends and we're at our barbecues or just, you know, meeting with family, and then the questions start. So even my wife will ask me questions on what exactly that we're doing out here.
The dewatering process is necessary for CAP inspectors to get inside the 9-foot in diameter, mile-long siphon that mostly runs underground south of Lake Pleasant.
This is extraordinary maintenance. The last time we got into and looked at this was 2018, and even then it was an inspection. But the last time we've done actual work on this, I would say, is more than 15 years ago.
Is that a typical period of time, sort of like, you know, getting your air conditioner replaced or something? Or
you can think of it like that.
Or maybe more like a canal colonoscopy, according to field maintenance director Rich Weisinger.
Part of our maintenance philosophy is to periodically get inside some of our equipment and our infrastructure. And this is one of the things we don't get to do very often, is dry up one of our siphons get inside and inspect.
He says most people don't get what the Central Arizona Project actually does.
The CAP in itself is difficult to understand. I don't think a lot of people know. It's kind of we call it the best kept secret in the valley, but it's very important to the state. Ensuring we get Colorado River water to our central southern Arizona.
It was created in 1968 when President Lyndon Johnson signed the Colorado River Basin Act. Today, it typically has more than 60 users, including the cities of Phoenix, Scottsdale, Mesa, Glendale, Peoria, and Tucson, along with 11 tribal nations. It also supplies several agricultural interests along the route. Weisinger has been at the CAP nearly half of its existence. When the Arizona native first started here, our current mega drought hadn't even begun.
We've had a kind of a dry spell for quite a few years. I've been here 27 years, so I've seen kind of the ebbs and flows in a cycle a little bit.
But he says the sense of urgency has changed.
We're in a time that's pretty concerning. We got a lot of work to do to ensure that this next negotiation or 2026 agreement, getting that redone, is really imperative to Arizona and to the ability to use this infrastructure to move water.
Weisinger is referring to more uncertainty facing the system as discussions continue on future allocations with the 7 states in Mexico that share the dwindling supply of Colorado River water.
We didn't really worry about where water was coming from, and so it has been concerning. It's nice to be able to communicate some of that to our field folks to ensure that so they feel confident that this infrastructure is going to be here for years to come. So yeah, that's changed in our mindset, how important this is.
With supplies dwindling, current rules for users of the Colorado River Basin expire at the end of next year. The system that right now at least carries 1.4 million acre feet of water throughout the state yearly to nearly 6 million Arizona users. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The modular builder who pulled out of a multi-million-dollar housing project on the Navajo Nation amid scrutiny by tribal leaders blamed what he calls the tribe's bureaucratic dysfunction for the project's abandonment. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Michel Marisco reports.
Zenni Home CEO Bob Worsley says the company was initially going to build 160 homes on the Navajo Nation when the order was suddenly halved to just 80.
So that was the thing that precipitated this crisis.
The former state senator says Zenni Home received $22 million from the Navajo Nation as a deposit for the company to set up its factory near Page, Arizona.
And we just looked at the numbers and the money we had spent to date to get it set up, to get plans approved, to get things engineered, to get a model home built and delivered to Window Rock, and to build the first units, and then to be told halfway through the relationship that we weren't going to get the other half of the money.
The plant shuttered just last week, and 210 people were laid off, having built just 18 homes. President Bhuvanagarn had vowed to build 1,000 new homes for the nation, where housing is in short supply. Worsley says the tribe declined his offer to let the nation take over the factory. The case has been at the epicenter of the latest battle between the Navajo president and the Navajo legislature. Earlier this week, Nagrin walked out of the State of the Navajo Nation address to the legislature after delegates questioned the Zenni Home deal.
We've become the rag doll being thrown around in our contract and our relationship because it's perceived that President Nagrin liked us and was working with us to expand our business there. And the council was trying to fight him on everything he was doing.
Nagrin himself has not responded to KJZZ's repeated request for an interview. In a statement, he said he will follow the law with respect to any investigation and that he walked out of the tribal address to avoid, quote, political theater. Meanwhile, legislators are still asking what happened with the funds.
What I do want to know is, how do you spend $24 million on 18 homes?
Eugenia Charles Newton serves on the nation's council. She says Zenni Home fell far short of delivering on its promises.
And in this case, we have not heard anything from Boo. He has not shared any information with us. He's been sending his staff while he goes on travel. So I have no idea at this point how to fix this, aside from we need him to start cooperating.
Chief among the council's investigations is to determine if $24 million in COVID relief funds were improperly spent on the project. KJZZ asked Worsley if the funds were going to be returned to the Navajo Nation or if they had all been spent.
Well, that'll come to light soon, and we'll have that discussion in court.
Worsley says he spent $50 million of his own money and investor funds to open the modular home factory on the nation. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. The Department of Interior is transferring public land along the Arizona-Mexico border to the U.S. military. It's the latest step in a Trump administration effort to create military zones along the international boundary. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, KJZZ's Elisa Resnick has more.
The first military zone was established along a stretch of New Mexico borderland in April. Similar plans were announced for the Yuma area last month. The Department of Interior now says it'll include a 285-acre section of the Roosevelt Reservation. That's a 60-foot strip of land that runs the length of the border in Arizona, New Mexico, and California. Miles Traphagen is with the Wildlands Network. He says he won't be surprised if the Trump administration expands military zones further from the border.
I'd be very surprised if it stays within the Roosevelt Reservation because the federal government already had access to that. And a lot of this land in western Arizona already interfaces with DOD-controlled land.
A Department of Interior spokesperson said additional military zone acreage will be announced at a later date. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
The so-called Epstein files have become a divisive issue for Republicans in Arizona's congressional delegation. From KJZZ's politics desk, Cameron Sanchez reports.
A House committee voted 8-2 on Wednesday to force the Justice Department to release the files. One of the two no votes was Arizona Congressman and gubernatorial candidate Andy Biggs. But Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar skipped the vote and has been quiet on the issue. On the other side of the coin, Arizona Republican Eli Crane is pushing for the files to be released. Democrats like Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego are seizing the opportunity to bash President Trump and accuse his supporters of backpedaling.
The American people are not stupid. They know something is off. They smell it. If Donald Trump really wants these files released, they'd be out already. Instead, he's orchestrating a cover-up, and he is not acting alone.
Gallego asked his colleagues to take up a resolution on Thursday asking the Justice Department to turn over the Epstein files, but Republicans shut it down. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
After floating the idea of reopening a shuttered federal prison on Alcatraz Island, President Trump tasked two of his cabinet members to see it for themselves last week. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, Trump's anti-immigration agenda is at odds with efforts in recent decades to honor the site's indigenous history.
The National Park Service has been stewarding the 22-acre island since 1972, which now attracts more than 1 million tourists and $60 million in revenue annually. But Interior Secretary Doug Burgum tells Fox News that could all change.
This was part of the Bureau of Federal Prisons, and returning it to that purpose is relatively straightforward compared to a lot of other transactions with federal land.
His predecessor, Deb Haaland, also visited in 2021 to respect the island's past.
Like many of the public lands in the care of the Department of the Interior, these lands tell a story, and you can feel it.
19 Hopi men were imprisoned there in 1895, punished for refusing to send their children to boarding schools. A 19-month occupation occurred 7 decades later. Lenato Warjack of the Shoshone Bannock tribes in Idaho was among them.
We took Alcatraz because it was bringing Indian land back into Indian custody. It meant a lot to me and to a lot of our people.
Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And here's a story from me. Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn says his department will make up for some of the federal funding that's being held up by the Trump administration. The money he's referring to is specifically set aside for school resource officers.
The U.S. Department of Education was due to release about $6 billion for 5 federal programs across the country earlier this month, but didn't. Of that, Arizona is due about $118 million. Now Horn says he's committed to making up for the $70,000 that would have gone to paying for school resource officers.
The federal government has delayed paying it while they review projects. They haven't actually canceled anything. But in the meantime, I'm going to fill it with state monies.
The Arizona Department of Education says there are about 8 or 9 officers funded by the federal government, which can easily be made up with money from the current state school safety program. Horn says the federal government is supposed to release another $24 million in grants for Arizona after school programs and the Boys and Girls Club. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, a conversation with local researchers who are working on a faster way to diagnose Valley fever. Here's co-host Mark Brody.
State health officials say there have been more than 7,500 cases of Valley fever reported so far this year. It's transmitted when people inhale fungal spores living in the ground. The majority of this year's cases have been reported in Maricopa County. The actual number of cases, though, is likely higher because diagnosing the fungal disease can be a challenge. But researchers at ASU and Mayo Clinic are working on a new, faster way to find out if a patient has Valley fever, and the result has been licensed by a company called Cactus Bio. Doug Lake joins me to talk about it. He's a professor at ASU and chair of foundational sciences at the new School of Medicine and Advanced Medical Engineering there. And Doug, what's the thought behind this new Valley fever test?
So the thought behind it is to have a rapid test, because currently the problem is somebody will go into an urgent care or an emergency department, and they'll have a pneumonia or some sort of maybe a respiratory infection. And the healthcare provider won't know, is it viral? Is it bacterial? Or around here, is it a fungal infection like Valley fever? So oftentimes they walk away with an antibiotic because the testing for Valley fever takes a long time. So it's anywhere between 3 days and 7 days, really, to get a result back. So we wanted to make a rapid test that would tell a healthcare provider, do you give that first dose of antibiotic? Or can you tell the patient, oh, you don't need antibiotics. Do you need other care, like an antifungal?
Is this the kind of thing that a chest X-ray can't identify? Like if you're not sure if it's, for example, pneumonia or COVID or Valley fever, like would a chest X-ray help identify that?
Right. So a chest X-ray is pretty much indistinguishable. So someone could have a pneumonia because of COVID. They could have a pneumonia because of a bacterial infection or even something non-infectious. So there's no way to tell. I mean, it could even look like cancer. So sometimes people, our healthcare provider will say, you know, you have a nodule in your lung. Maybe you should go see an oncologist. So, and it turns out, you know, the good news is it turns out to be Valley fever instead of cancer.
So it sounds like your test works kind of on the same principle as sort of the rapid COVID test that many of us became familiar with, except instead of shoving a swab up your nose, you take a blood draw?
Yeah. So that's exactly right. So our test works on a finger stick, and it also works by blood draw. So a person would go in and get normal phlebotomy, and either plasma or serum would be obtained from that tube of blood. And then just a tiny drop of blood on that test and a few drops of chase buffer, just like we do with our COVID tests. Mm-hmm. And 10 minutes later, you know whether you have antibodies to Valley fever. So we're looking for antibodies, which is indicative of an active infection.
How certain can one be of the results? Like if you have the antibodies, how certain are you that you have Valley fever? And conversely, if you don't have the antibodies, how certain are you that you do not have Valley fever?
Right. So the test looks for antibodies, as I mentioned. And if antibodies are present, it's very likely that and symptoms match. Mm-hmm. For example, a chest X-ray. So there's a constellation of symptoms that people might have if they have Valley fever. They might have night sweats. They might have a cough, extreme fatigue, and along with those symptoms, they also might have a nodule in their chest. You know, by chest X-ray, and along with those symptoms, if they have a positive antibody test. We're in the high 90 percentile range that they actually do have Valley fever. And if they're negative and they still have these symptoms, we're also in the high 90 percentile range that they don't have Valley fever. They have something else.
But as you were saying, it sounds like this is not sort of the be-all end-all. It's a big piece of the diagnosis or ruling something out, but maybe not the only component of it.
Right, exactly. So things have to match, right? So if you come in with a headache only and you do a test, you can have other symptoms that may be contributory, but a healthcare provider has to put the pieces together, and this test aids in the diagnosis of the disease.
How is this test different than the test you mentioned earlier that could take maybe 3 to 7 days? Like, are those also looking for antibodies, or are they sort of a totally different path?
So those tests also look for antibodies, but they have to be sent so that once again, a tube of blood would be drawn. So our test uses a finger stick, but you can also run the test with a tube of blood. So the current tests, you have to go in and get phlebotomy, and then it's sent to a central laboratory. Because only very skilled personnel can do those sorts of tests. They're very complicated, and only central labs do those tests.
Are yours more of like an at-home kind of thing? Like, could I do it in my kitchen like I did with COVID tests?
Right. So we're hoping we're going to get there with an at-home test. Currently, we're pursuing FDA or an FDA regulatory strategy so that we have to march through all the forms and all the FDA regulatory paperwork in order to get approval for either an at-home test or a CLIA waived test, which would be something that an urgent care department could do, for example.
Is it the going to that location that takes the time, or is there some new technology that enables the antibodies to either make themselves known or not more quickly than the tests that we have now?
So the first thing is it has to be sent to a central laboratory that where a laboratory professional is trained to do those sorts of tests. And the other reason is that the tests that we're currently using were developed in the 60s. And so things move faster now that we're in 2025 than they did in 1960. So the tests are just the nature of the tests are much slower. The nature of the current tests are much slower.
In the world of Valley fever, how important is it to have this kind of test, do you think, where somebody can find out quickly and accurately whether or not they have it? And I ask mostly because I know that diagnosis is one of the impediments to people either getting treated or to really even knowing how prevalent this disease is.
Absolutely. So this, we hope will really, this rapid test, we hope will be a game changer for the diagnosis of Valley fever, because currently even the CDC guidelines start with patients that are not responding on antibiotics. So that means they've already been misdiagnosed. So we want to avoid that first dose of antibiotic that the patient gets so that they can be properly diagnosed right away. Because as you know, you don't want to take the wrong drug. If you take the wrong drug, then it's not helping you.
Well, and you don't want to take antibiotics if you don't have to also, right?
Exactly. And so healthcare providers are excited about this because it provides an opportunity for proper antibiotic stewardship.
All right. Doug, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Sure. I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Doug Lake is a professor at ASU and chair of foundational sciences at the new School of Medicine and Advanced Medical Engineering there.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Bridget Dowd. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more online and on the KJZZ mobile app.